Hello, and welcome back to the Offspring Magazine podcast. It's Bea, and I will be hosting today's podcast. Today we will be talking to Professor Joachim Marotzke, who is the director of the department The Ocean in the Earth's System at the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg. We will release this episode in two parts, since we did have a two-hour conversation. So in part one, we talk about the role the ocean plays in our Earth system and how it affects climate change. We talk about the rising sea levels and ocean currents and how they are affected by the rise in global temperature. We do spend a lot of time talking about the use of climate models in climate change science, as well as their reliability. So if you're not at all interested in climate models, then you can skip this short part in part one and stay tuned for part two. In part two, which will be released next week, we will talk more about the rising sea levels, how much we should be worried about rising sea levels, and some of the solutions, including nature-based solutions, to prevent the effects of rising sea levels. We also go into a more political discussion about the politics of climate change. We also talk about Professor Marotzke's opinion on renewable energy versus nuclear energy. And in general, we discuss what we think that Germany is doing right and wrong regarding climate change. But that's part two, so for now, please enjoy part one. Hello, thank you so much for joining the podcast today. Why don't you just start by introducing yourself?
Hello, I'm Joachim Marotzke. I'm one of the directors here at the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology, and we do climate research here at this institute.
Yeah, very hot topic these days.
Very hot, yes.
Yeah, so what kind of research do you specifically do? Because climate change is such a large field of study.
It's a big field. We do fundamental research into how climate change functions. On our webpage, we say we investigate the changing climate of our Earth. That's what we do. So this is pretty broad. So we research not only the human-caused climate change, we also do a lot of research on how climate functions in principle. Sometimes how climate functions on other planets, or how climate may have functioned 700 million years ago on Earth. So we take a very, very broad view of the changing climate of our Earth. But part of it is, of course, how humans change the climate.
Yeah, I think a lot of talk in the media right now is solely focused on the way that humans influence climate change. There's not so much talk on maybe the natural variability, or actually really interesting that you also study how on other planets climate change affects
that. True. And of course, it's understandable, because what many people are concerned with, what affects people's lives, is of course how humans are changing climate now and what we can do about it. If we look at how climate works on other planets, or may have worked in the past, I would see that more as a general scientific interest. Maybe the same way how people are interested in how a supernova functions, or the recent photograph of a black hole. And so it's exciting for those interested in science, but it speaks sort of really to a very different desire compared to when people are concerned with how humans are changing Earth's climate right now.
Yeah. Yes, I definitely want to be going back to talking about also how climate change affects other planets, because that sounds very interesting. But maybe let's just start more by talking about specifically what you do. I saw on your website that you're the director for like oceans and the influence on their atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
So that research.
Yeah, I call it, when I started, I thought a bit about it, and I called it The Ocean in the Earth System. And that's really our program, and has been ever since. So we look at how the ocean functions, but not so much the ocean per se, but really how the ocean plays a role in climate, in the interaction with the atmosphere. And so some of what we do is purely how the ocean works, but a lot of it is how ocean atmosphere interacts. And also a big part is how ocean absorbs and transports carbon around. Carbon is very important for climate change. Humans are changing the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere. Some of that goes into the ocean. And there is a question, will that continue to be like that? Will the ocean continue to take up carbon? Where does that carbon go? And so on. So that is also what we do. So very much from this, as we say, from the coupled perspective, the ocean as part of a larger system. That's really the focus of what we do.
So then let's start by talking about the ways in which the ocean can take up carbon and how it's impacted by climate change.
Yeah, the ocean takes up about one quarter of what humans emit into the atmosphere. Very roughly, of things we emit into the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide, half stays in the atmosphere, half goes into the land biosphere, plants on land, and half goes into the half remains in the atmosphere. One quarter goes into the land biosphere, and one quarter goes into the ocean, very roughly. And the processes by which they go into the ocean, that carbon goes into the ocean, they are reasonably well understood. Part of it is dissolved in the surface ocean, and then some is transported downward by ocean currents. Some is taken up by plankton, by small plants in the ocean, and they consume the carbon, and they die, and some of that debris falls down to the deeper ocean and takes carbon down. So we know in principle how it functions, but the big unknown is how will that change in the future.
Yeah.
We know the areas in the ocean where that downward transfer occurs. It's mostly in the North Atlantic and in the ring of ocean around Antarctica called the Southern Ocean. And especially the Southern Ocean, it's very hard to predict how they will change in the future, because the processes there are difficult to simulate in our models. And because they are difficult to simulate, it's hard to predict how they will change. And so much of our effort is geared towards building better models of the ocean that then will do a better, more reliable job of predicting how in the future the Southern Ocean will take up carbon and transport that carbon down.
So oceans are extremely important to act as carbon sinks, basically.
They are very important to act as carbon sinks. The oceans really play an important role here. And in some way, the ocean does us a dual service, us humankind. The ocean does two things to slow down climate change. One is, as I said, the ocean takes up a quarter of the carbon. Let's imagine a world without an ocean, then all that carbon would remain in the atmosphere and climate change would progress faster, would proceed faster. So there's one service that the ocean does to us. The ocean does another service. It takes up energy, it takes up heat, and that slows down the climate change. If the ocean did not absorb that heat and transfer it down, then also climate change will progress faster. So the ocean does two services, takes up heat, in a way it cools, it tempers the heating, and the ocean takes up the carbon. But the ocean also pays a dear price for that.
Yeah.
For the carbon, it takes up the carbon, the price it pays, it gets more acidic. It's ocean acidification, which, for example, attacks some of the small animals that live, those that form shells, calciferous shells, and so the ocean gets more acidic, and it's harder for some living entities to survive in the ocean.
Yeah.
The other price the ocean pays, it expands.
Exactly. Yeah.
It takes up the heat, does us a service. But it expands because it gets warmer, warmer water expands, and so the sea level rises. So that service of the ocean does not come for free, and it will not go on forever. So the ocean helps us, But there is a price to pay, and it won't last for eternity.
Yeah, well, like with everything, there's always advantages and disadvantages to a system.
There's always a price to pay. There's no such a thing as a free lunch, and we have that too. That slowing down of climate change through the ocean comes with consequences.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, so sea levels are rising. I think most people also are well aware of the fact that sea levels are rising. So are we talking about sea levels rising everywhere, or are there particular places in the ocean where the sea levels are rising more?
It's not homogeneous, so the sea levels are not rising everywhere, and that makes it, that's another big part of also the research we do to understand why they are not rising the same way everywhere. For example, if you look in the tropical eastern Pacific, sea levels have been falling over the past 20 to 30 years. They have not been rising.
Okay.
Now, this has been taken by climate change deniers as to poo-poo the result that sea levels go up, which is complete nonsense, because on global average, it's very clear that sea level rises. And the fact that in some parts of the ocean, sea level goes down a bit means it rises ever faster in other parts, say the Western tropical Pacific. There, sea level has risen at about twice the global rate. So there's a heterogeneity in how sea level rises. Part of it comes from how the wind drives ocean currents.
Okay.
And therefore the winds may change. We have seen a strengthening of the wind system in the eastern tropical Pacific, what we call the trade winds. They blow more from the northeast, the classical trade winds, we probably all know them, and they have increased in strength for a reason that we don't understand. And because they have increased in strength, they've pushed waters more to the western edge of the Pacific, and that has led to this decrease in sea level in the eastern Pacific. As I said, we don't really know why that is, but it's well observed. And so one of the questions we then have, and of course a question that that people who live on the small islands in the Pacific have, is, will this pattern continue? Will there continue to be more sea level in the western tropical Pacific compared to the east? Will that pattern change? And it's very hard to say. We're really not sure there.
Yeah.
And there's another, maybe more, almost for most people, probably exotic way of why sea level is not the same everywhere. And that is, if you look at Greenland. Greenland has a massive ice sheet. It's about 3 kilometers thick. And that ice sheet is melting. And that melting ice that melts to water flows into the ocean. And sea level rises. But there is one other effect that is not so obvious. That big, fat, massive ice sheet sitting there also exerts a gravitational pull, a horizontal gravitational pull on the water.
Huh.
And because that water, that ice sheet goes down, the gravitational pull, the horizontal pull towards Greenland gets less. And therefore, the net effect of, in the vicinity of Greenland melting, is actually that sea level drops in the very
makes
vicinity
sense.
Of Greenland. And the water is exported elsewhere. Elsewhere, of course, the sea level rises more than average. So this is a really peculiar way of, when one first hears it, very surprising aspect of sea level rise, of inhomogeneous sea level rise. And the third contribution that people in Scandinavia see that very clearly, that locally there, sea level also falls. It does not rise, it falls. And what we see there is that Scandinavia still recovers from the last ice age, in the sense that there was also a massive ice sheet sitting on Scandinavia, suppressing Scandinavia into the Earth's mantle, that ice melted, and now we see what we call the post-glacial rebound. The pressure is off, and now the land rises, and the land rises faster than the sea level goes up. So locally, sea level falls.
Yeah.
So we have a number, if every person looked at where they live, it's not at all clear to say by how much sea level rises, and maybe even whether it rises. But just to make that absolutely clear, most people, where most people live, they are affected by sea level rise. If we look at many of the big cities in the world, almost all of them experience rise of the surrounding sea level. That is very clear. But the picture is complicated.
Yeah, it seems very complicated. I think maybe not everywhere sea level rises, but you also assume that on average sea level is rising.
Average sea level rises, and as I sometimes say, sea level is like taxes and death.
Yeah.
It comes for sure.
There's
no way of escaping it. And we have already, through the warming we have created in the past, we have already committed for centuries, really centuries of further sea level rise that is completely unpreventable, unstoppable. There will be sea level rise for a long time to come, just from that 1 degree of global warming that we as humans have already caused. And sea level remembers that past warming history for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah. So we talked briefly about that since the ocean is warming, that's one of the contributing factors for why sea level is rising. Are there any other reasons why the sea level is rising other than temperature?
The main other contribution is that land ice melts, and so the large ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica, but also alpine or mountain glaciers in the Alps, Alaska, the Himalayas, there are lots of glaciers, and they melt almost everywhere in the world. 97% or so of all mountain glaciers reduce in volume, and that water eventually flows into the ocean, and that also leads to sea level rise. Currently, we estimate that about half of the sea level rise is due to the ocean warming and expanding. The other half is from land ice melting and that water flowing into the ocean. But we expect that in the future, the contribution from the land ice melt will increase and will dominate the total sea level rise. There are small contributions from other effects, for example, whether land, the ground, soils can store more water, the groundwater level may increase or decrease. That's an effect that is important seasonally. Say, when there is an El Nino, then that influences how much water is stored.
What's an El Nino?
I'm sorry.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah. El Nino is a warming of the tropical eastern Pacific, and sometimes around Christmas time, when it gets unusually warm there, and then the whole weather patterns in and around the Pacific changes, and for example, then where it's normally dry in Mesoamerica and in South America, southern North America, they may have torrential rainfalls. On the other side, Indonesia, when it's normally very wet, they have unusually dry climate when an El Nino event happens. And it's called El Nino, the Spanish for the child, because it was first observed around Christmas. So it was named after the Christ child. And El Nino influences plant growth on land. It influences how much water is stored on land. So we see in measurements, when an El Nino happens, we can see some change in sea level because some more water is stored on land. But long term, that effect is very minor. And the two really big effects, the two ones that count, is the ocean warms and expands, and there's less ice on land, and that water flows into the ocean.
One more brief question about the El Nino. So does that happen like every year? Does that happen on a regular basis? I don't know, every 5 years, or is it completely random?
It's irregular. It's not completely random. It happens sort of every 2 to 7 years. And you can see from that stretch.
Yeah.
It's quite irregular. But if we had a period for 10 years without El Nino, we would start wondering what's happening. So there's a certain regularity in it, but not much, and it's always the height of it is always around December, January, February, so it's tied to the seasons, and what we always have if an El Nino event has happened, the year after tends to be very warm globally.
Okay.
You may say, ah, but this is the, you said, tropical Pacific, but the tropical Pacific is large. It's huge. Mm. The Pacific is a huge ocean, and the tropics take up a lot of space. And so if the tropical Pacific is warmer than usual, that leaves an imprint also on the global average, because the tropical Pacific is so large. And therefore, the year following an El Nino event, or a year that has an El Nino event in January, February, tends to be warmer than usual. And you may have seen that at, I think the last year, I'm afraid I can't quite get the name, I would have to look up the exact year, where it was 2016, that we say, or maybe it was 2018 was not an El Nino year, and still it was very warm.
So I remember, that's true, but 2018, 2019 was very warm.
Yeah, I think the 2016 followed a large El Nino, and 2016 has been the record year, if I got my dates right off the top of my head.
We can always fact check that and put it in the show notes.
Yeah, there was one of the other years, and I think it was 2018, where, and this is why this was so remarkable, that we said, well, in some way, no El Nino to push the temperature up, and still it was very warm.
Do we know why?
No. There are other things that influence the global temperatures on a year-to-year basis, so it, global temperature fluctuates on a year-to-year basis, plus minus 0.2 degrees we could have. So for some way, for no apparent reason, a year could be warmer by 0.2 degrees or colder by 0.2 degrees. If an El Nino happened before, then we say, we know why it may be warmer than usual. But there are many other things that fluctuate. The other big part of the globe, if you wish, is Eurasia, Siberia. It's a huge landmass. And it's very strongly influenced by random variability in the atmosphere. So we've seen a period, the early 2000s, say, we've seen a period of about 15 years where there was an unusual cooling trend in winter over Siberia. Mm. And it happened.
Yeah.
Sometimes things just happen, and with no apparent cause, and that also contributes to fluctuations in the global atmospheric temperature.
Yeah, I know. That's why I often think, I guess thinking a bit about climate models as well, sometimes I find it very hard to grasp how you guys measure what kind of global temperature rise is because of humans, what is because of the natural variability, and then how you all put that into climate models to try to predict what's going to happen or explain certain things.
Well, you're asking the right question. It is one of the most difficult questions to answer in our field, and one of the most important questions to answer. How much of the fluctuation we see, or how much of the change we see, maybe I should put it this way, how much of the change we see is due to natural fluctuation, and how much is due to the human effect? And it's very, very hard to do. By now, we have a clear answer on the warming, the global surface warming, and the latest statement we made in the report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is this group of scientists asked by the United Nations every 6 to 7 years to assess
the IPCC
to assess what we know about climate. And in our latest report we published last year in August, we wrote, it is unequivocal that human influence has warmed the atmosphere, the ocean, and the land surface. Unequivocal. There is no scientific doubt that we as humans are responsible for that warming. Took a long time to get to this certainty. But for temperature rise, we can say this was humans. There is no scientific doubt. For other quantities, it's much harder to say. For example, has strong precipitation, it has increased in places. Was that the human effect? And if you look, and we also put that in, there's only one region in the world. We divided the world into 42 different regions. And for each region, my colleagues said, how certain are we, how much confidence do we have that it was really the human effect that led to this increase in strong precipitation? And of the 42, there's one region, Scandinavia, Northern Europe, where we are really confident that it was humans. There is one other region, Central North America, where we are moderately sure it was, where we have moderate confidence that it was the human effect. And everywhere else, 40 other reasons, there's low confidence that the observed trend is due to humans. We just don't know. It may well be, we can't exclude it, and it may well emerge as a human-driven change in the future, but currently we are not sure. And so we have this huge range. For temperature, we are certain.
Yeah.
For precipitation change, strong precipitation events, it's very unclear yet. So, and that shows how difficult, as a general problem, how difficult this separation into human effect, natural variability is. And this is why the fact that it's so difficult is, of course, also the reason why Klaus Hasselmann last year won the Nobel Prize in Physics. He was the founding director of my institute here. And Klaus Hasselmann showed us in 1979, in a breathtaking paper, how in principle we could discern the human fingerprint in all those fluctuations, in all that noise, how to go about it. And the difficulty of the problem is properly reflected in the fact that he received the Nobel Prize for that.
That was actually my next question. How can you, with global temperature rise, how can you be certain that it is also because of humans, whereas then with the precipitation, you're not sure? Like, what is there in those models that make you certain?
Well, maybe the most important thing it is in the observations.
Yes, that's true.
Models are indispensable for understanding what is going on, and also for detecting the human influence. But at the bottom of everything is the observation, and that temperatures have gone up. And what Hasselmann did was, he said, look, if I just took temperature measurements all over the globe, I have many very good records, hundreds of good stations that have measured temperature for a long time. He showed and argued why it is a difficult statistical problem to find out that really things are going up and for a particular reason and not just like that. And what he then suggested is the following. Let us, rather than trying to build the effect of or the influence of humans from the individual station data and piece it together, let us use a model, and let us use a model to say, what do we expect? What pattern do we expect? And models show us very clearly what pattern to expect. For example, at the surface, the Arctic warms a lot faster than the rest of the globe. That's what models show us we should expect from an increase in CO2 in the atmosphere. There's another effect that models show us we should expect, another pattern, which is the stratosphere should cool. The region in the atmosphere above, say, 12, 14 kilometers, depending on where you are. The troposphere is where the weather occurs. The troposphere will warm, but the stratosphere will cool. And that's a very robust result from models, and we understand well why that happens. So there's another pattern. CO2 increase means tropospheric warming, stratospheric cooling. So we have two elements of a pattern. And then Hasselmann said, and now let us assume the pattern is there, that's our hypothesis, and let's see whether we find that pattern in the observations. And it's much, much easier to look for a pattern than trying to piece something together afterwards. And he showed that what we call statistical significance, so has the signal risen out of the noise, is much, much improved by doing it this way. And that was the way in which he and his group, people working with him, some 20 when was it, 25, 26 years ago, could identify the human fingerprint in climate.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is, I've been asked this question and I don't know the answer, whether this idea to first define a pattern and then look for it, whether this has been used in other areas of science. I don't know whether it has.
Yeah.
In our field, this came out of nothing, his idea to do this. Define the pattern first and then look for it. But you probably noticed that when the gravitational waves were discovered 5-6 years ago, for which people got the confirmation of general relativity theory by Einstein, and people got the Nobel Prize for that. That detection followed the same principle. With a numerical model, people first defined patterns they were looking for in the data, and then they identified the pattern in the data that they got from those huge observatories. So that idea is much more general than just from climate research, but I have not, maybe my ignorance speaking, but I don't know that this idea has been expressed in another field of research, and that's another reason. So it's a very, very general strategy for detecting a signal in noisy data, and another reason why this deservedly won the Nobel Prize in physics, because it's really such a broad fundamental idea that it applies to many other areas of physics too.
Yeah. Do you use this kind of idea of detecting a pattern first in, I don't know, when you study the ocean or rising sea levels?
We don't at this institute any longer, which is maybe a bit ironic, but the idea has taken off and is applied all over the world.
Yeah.
Say the person working with Klaus then, she was a postdoc here, Gabriele Hegel, she's now a professor at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And many other people use these techniques, and in the reports by the IPCC, the 6 reports have come out, and every one of them had a chapter or a subchapter on what's called detection and attribution, building on Hasselmann's idea. Now that they have other ideas have joined that, but the core of answering the questions, are humans responsible for this change, is the method that was invented by Klaus Hasselmann. So that there has been a huge legacy in the field. And I would say if we hadn't been so sure that it's humans responsible for the observed climate change, for crucial parts of the observed climate change, I am sure there would never have been a Paris Agreement on curbing further climate change, because the doubts would have lingered too strongly. Is it really us humans, which implies can really do something, but it goes back to Hasselmann's work that we were so certain, and we could already in 2015 or around 2010 we could say, okay, there's a tiny margin of error, but yeah, we just wait a bit. We know it's the humans.
Yeah. So another question about climate models that I always find very hard to understand is just climate change is so complex. There are so many things that you need to factor in when you use climate models. So how do you make sure that you really factor in everything?
We can't ever be sure that everything is in there. So we got to be humble there. But we're reasonably certain that we're not missing anything that's really important.
And I guess you could always change, like maybe your climate models also change year by year, if you design them differently, or you factor in something
well,
that you've discovered.
Well, the model remains the same. It may be worth explaining what a climate model is, how it functions.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
There's, one way of characterizing it, what we sometimes say, it's a digital twin of the real Earth. So we try to build the real Earth, but in a digital universe. And what do we mean by that? Most important thing is, we know the real climate is governed by some fundamental laws of nature. Mass is conserved, energy is conserved, momentum is conserved, so Newton's laws of motion. These are fundamental laws of nature. We know if you go to the very small, the very big, and so on, the very fast, that you have effects where these classic laws of classical physics are no longer valid. But for climate, we know that these laws are true and are valid. Newton's laws of motion, energy is conserved, mass is conserved, water is conserved. And we express these conservations mathematically. There are equations that we know are correct. And then we solve these equations on computers. Now, that's when it gets tricky. These equations are very, very hard. They have a very complicated mathematical structure. They're very hard to solve. We have turbulence in them, which makes life hard, which makes equations hard to solve. And so what we do is we solve the equations not in, as we say, in the continuous form, that for a continuum at every point in the world this equation is valid. We solve the equation on what we call a grid or a mesh. We say we have one grid point maybe here, and the next one is 50 kilometers away.
Okay.
And we assume that this grid point is representative for its surroundings. And when we do that, we can solve these equations on a large computer. We start from some initial state, say, what did the ocean do a year ago? And we start from that state, and then we use the equation, and the equations tell me how things evolve in the future. And that we do many times over, and then when we've done that, so that is also why I mean we create a digital twin. The observed world does not enter, not in the first instance. We really create a digital twin of the Earth, if you wish, from scratch. Mm-hmm. It is created independently of what we observe. And what we then do is we take observations and check how well are we doing. The global warming of the 20th century, do we reproduce that in a sensible way? Or the temperature patterns we have, well, tropics are warm, poles are cold. The temperature drop from the tropics to the pole, does our model recreate that?
Yeah.
From the laws of nature. So we as a field, we've done thousands of tests of these models, and that is awesome. That's often overlooked. If you look at the publications in climate research and modeling papers, the large majority of modeling papers has to do with the evaluation of the models.
Yeah, I can imagine.
To see how well are we doing, and if we're not doing well, why is that? And that usually gives us a hint at what to do better. So we look at how processes occur. Sometimes we have very good observations of certain processes, say in how a cloud forms and how the air rises, their observations. And we try to look in models. How do the models do that? And when we find discrepancies, we try to improve the representation of clouds in models. And so this is also why this goes on unnoticed by the public. This is technical work, really, really important work, but technical work for an outsider, not very exciting. If I tell you, well, the model is too warm east of Boston by 1.5 degree, you would say, well, I couldn't care less.
Yeah.
Rightly so. Why should anyone outside our field be excited about it? And that's just fine. But it's a foundation on which statements are built, which then do catch the interest of the public.
And I guess that's also why I'm so interested in how good the climate models really are, because in the end, you make statements based on the models.
Yeah. And so what we do is, so the typical part of, or a large part of modeling is this type of evaluation for which we need observations, we need measurements. And that also makes this question of how good are the models for the purpose or how good are the predictions. That makes it difficult. In the fifth assessment report of the IPCC, the one that came out in 2013, I was one of the two people in charge of the chapter on model evaluation. Huh. And so I can tell firsthand what happened. What did people want to know? Essentially, largely they wanted to know, tell us the models are good enough for what we apply them for.
Yeah.
But please spare us the gory detail. I'm exaggerating a bit. But we felt a bit like the bit shady cousin of the family. We got to invite him, but let's not seat him at the center table.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because the contents of the chapter is technical, and I think for many people not very exciting.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But just absolutely necessary and also difficult. I mean, the epistemology of model evaluation is really hard because I can only check the models for the past. But what people want to know is how good are our predictions for the 21st century? And that's hard. That's very hard because normally if you contrast that with weather forecasting, we've had thousands and thousands of days for which to check our weather forecast.
Yeah.
Wait till tomorrow and you'll see whether the forecast was good. Not quite that simple. Even weather forecasting evaluation, if I say there's a 50% chance of rain tomorrow and it rains, does that mean my forecast was good? So just checking tomorrow does not cut it. But still, weather forecasting has had so many instances of being checked. They know very well what they do well and what they do not do well. It's much harder for us. If I make a forecast for 2100, I got to wait 80 years to check that forecast. I mean, that's nonsensical.
Yeah.
I don't want to wait. I can't wait. And my forecast is always conditioned on human behavior in the future. So this is a hard, fundamentally hard problem, and we try to make educated guesses of what we think is needed to make a good forecast. There's a philosopher of science, Wendy Parker, who wrote about the adequacy for purpose. And she said, let us look into the future. If I want to make a good forecast for 2050 for temperature, global temperature, what do I need to get right? What do I think I need to get right in order to make a good forecast? And then let me check back whether these things are fulfilled in the past. So I'm breaking down the model into smaller pieces. I'm not just asking, is this a good model? Is this model reliable? That's too big a question. But is this model adequate for this particular purpose?
Yeah.
And although I can never find an absolutely definitive answer for such a long-term prediction, at least I cannot, not in my lifetime, I find decent and maybe useful answers.
Yeah.
And that is how we work. That is why eventually we build trust in our models, or where we know, we really got to be careful with models here.
Yeah. Would you say that the field is mainly based on what the models predict in the future and you kind of research what's going to happen in the future, or you more look at the past and say, this is what we have in the past, and based on the past, these are the decisions that we're going to make in the future?
I would have to guess, because someone would have to look at the actual body of literature, but my guess is that overall more papers are published on the past, because that's where we have the observation. So all observational work in that sense is geared towards the past, directed towards the past. The model evaluation looks at the past, and so even though there are many papers looking at the predictions for the future, I think the majority of the papers are published on things that lie in the past.
Yeah.
Just out of necessity, but also because at some level, if you want to Somewhere models can never tell us what the world is, how the world is. That can only come from empirical evidence. Models help us explore our ideas and deepen our ideas. They help us find consistency between different observations. There are many things that the models do and that why models are necessary. But they can never tell us that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And so for that there's always, if you wish, in terms of papers written, number of papers written, it's probably always have to be a bias towards the past. It's almost has to be.
I feel like that's a natural thing as well, because you're certain about the past. You're not certain about not the future.
And I think so. That would have to be checked. I mean, someone almost like a sociologist of climate research would have to check whether what I say is true just from the published literature. But it's definitely what I expect. Because that builds a foundation for those who want to look into the future.
Yeah, I mean, I've completely sidetracked. I told myself in this podcast, I'm going to be talking about climate models at the end, because I don't know how many people are interested in climate models. And then we just talked, I don't know, 40 minutes on climate models at the beginning. So let's go back to rising sea levels.
Yeah.
That's part one. Thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to learn more about Professor Joachim Marotzke and his research, you can look at his website. And if you like our podcasts, make sure to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our Instagram page. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week for part two. Bye!
Offspring Magazine, the podcast, is brought to you by the Max Planck PhD Net Science Communication Group, known as the Offspring Magazine. The intro-outro music is composed by Srinath Ramkumar, and the pre-intro jingle is composed by Gustavo Carrizo. If you have any feedback, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to write us at offspring.podcasts@phdnet.mpg.de. Until next week, stay safe, stay healthy. Bye!